Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is Larry Tyes. Many people in Chapel Hill know Larry because he's been around a long time. Most recently, I guess, Larry, that we know you as a professor, now retired, I guess, but many years as the Wilbur Norval Wright Distinguished Professor of History at East Carolina University.
Yes.
But you're the man, you're the history man in North Carolina. You've done everything in the realm of history.
Well, when I moved to Pennsylvania in 1981, I had no idea that I would keep so much tar on my heel, or at least on one
hill. Why do you live in Philadelphia when you got so many North Carolina connections?
I'd love Philadelphia. Philadelphia is like pig and slop as far as history goes. I mean, it has every imaginable library you could ever want. You have access to books. I'm connected with the University of Pennsylvania, and I'm a fellow at the McNeil Center at the University of Pennsylvania, and I have been since 1989.
So you got a library card there.
I have library access, and I can borrow books from any Ivy League university I want to, including actually Duke also, and I can have the books delivered to me within 24 hours, or actually 48 hours.
Well, isn't it? I mean, you could have a lot of that at Duke and Carolina, and even at East Carolina, where the libraries are coming into the modern age in terms of being able to get the books.
But there's a big difference. I can go to a lecture in Philadelphia every day on history. And I can go to the Philadelphia Orchestra, and I can do the Pennsylvania Ballet.
Well, I'm not going to talk anymore because a lot of people say they live in Chapel Hill or Durham.
But I have my home in Winston-Salem. I grew up in Winston-Salem.
And you got a house there?
I have my family home there, and people ask me how often I get there, and I say whenever the grass needs to be mowed, I'm there. And that's true.
That's fantastic. Well, before we get started talking about your most recent of your many books, is a book called Circa 1903. And well, let's start talking about it right now. The subtitle is North Carolina's Outer Banks at the Dawn of Flight.
Right.
And you've written about flight, but you led us when we celebrated the centennial of flight. You were the history man for that effort. What else is there to be said about 1903?
Well, I selected circa 1903 because that's the year the Wright brothers had their first powered flight. They actually learned to fly long before 1903, but they didn't put an engine on their plane until 1903. But I wanted to provide a context to talk about a very interesting time in the coast of North Carolina. Because the Wright brothers, when they came to North Carolina, they described it as being like, or the coast as being like the ends of the earth. And Wilbur described Kitty Hawk. He took the train into Elizabeth City and said nobody in Elizabeth City knew where Kitty Hawk was. And that was hogwash. Everybody knew where Kitty Hawk was.
I thought the Wright brothers made Kitty Hawk famous. I didn't know it was famous before that.
Oh well, Kitty Hawk was a very successful and important fishing center. It was a fishing town.
To go out in the sound or to go to the ocean.
Yes, into the sound basically. Mm-hmm. But one of the points I wanted to make in this book is that people think of the coast of North Carolina as being important because of tourism. But long before tourism, the coast of North Carolina was extremely successful economically. And unfortunately, the switch to tourism as the focus of economy on the coast of North Carolina pretty much destroyed a lot of what made the coast of North Carolina very, very successful commercially.
Well, were people getting rich off of the fishing? I mean,
absolutely.
How did that work? I mean, because there was nobody to sell the fish to close by in eastern North Carolina, was there? I mean, it was the—
Are you kidding? They built a transportation system which included trains, it included steamboats, it included all kinds of craft going back and forth around the Sound region, which I called North Carolina's Inland Sea, so that you could catch fish anywhere in the Sound region of North Carolina and pack the fish and ship it overnight, and the next day the fish would be in Washington and Baltimore and would be served on tables there. And within 2 days, the fish, still fresh, would arrive in Philadelphia and New York. I mean, North Carolina provided the fish, the shellfish, the turtles that people were eating all up and down the eastern seaboard.
And tourism, you say, has destroyed that, or is it just a redistribution of the way you can get fresh fish or fish to the table from other places?
Well, fishing has changed a lot, and fishing is a more of a global industry. And as far as fishing goes, there's a lot of fishing out of Wanches today, but it's very different. When I say it destroyed the industry, I'm talking about in the 1920s when the people on the coast started promoting North Carolina as a tourist attraction based on history, historical topics. Mm-hmm.
We might want to come back to the economics of 1903, right. but history is real important. I mean, in your life, I mean, it's put cereal on your table for a long time. But how did history and tourism? What was the negative aspect of that?
Well, unfortunately, so much of the tourism history is, I hate to use the term fake history, but it is varnished history. You know, for example, on the North Carolina license plate, we have First in Flight, and people refer to the Wright brothers' flight on December 17th, 1903, as the first flight. Well, that's not true.
First empowered flight? Can we say that?
You have to do more than that.
What do you have to say?
You have to say it was the first man-controlled powered flight that took off at one spot and landed at a spot that was not lower than the spot from where it took off. You have to say all of that in order to describe.
Well, because other people have done the other things.
Yeah,
first.
The other things had been done.
What was the first powered flight?
The first powered flight? There was a powered flight in France before.
But it didn't take off and land at a higher place.
It wasn't controlled.
It was.
The Wright brothers invented controls.
So this is when you say they were flying long before 1903, or many years.
Yeah,
many
yeah well, the Wright brothers were flying before 1903.
And they were flying kites, right? Or they were flying?
No, they were flying. They were flying gliders, mm-hmm. controlled gliders, not powered. In fact, most people don't know it, but the patent that the Wright brothers got in 1906 was on a flying machine without an engine.
So they patented their sophisticated
control system,
controlled but non-powered
right.
Yes. Airplanes. I
mean, and that's their grandfather patent, which was upheld by the federal courts.
And was that the key to their success? Was their ability to control the apparatus once they got it in the air?
Exactly, and actually, it's very sad because the Wright brothers didn't want anybody to see their flights. First of all, they didn't want people to see their failures, but secondly, they suspected, and as it turned out, they were exactly right that if anybody saw their planes in flight, the systems could be replicated. And so, in 1908, the Wright brothers went to Kill Devil Hills. They flew a more substantial plane than the one they flew in 1903. And when they left there, Wilbur went to France and Orville went to Washington, D.C., and they both flew publicly for the first time.
And did they, had they gotten the kind of patent protection that they needed?
Yes, by that time they had a patent. And in fact, they had patents in all of those countries. They had patents in France and England and Germany and Austria and Spain and Italy. But when they flew publicly at Washington, Fort Myer, and then also in Le Mans, France, within 6 months, the French were building better airplanes than the Wright brothers. And so the Wright brothers were completely surpassed by other engineers.
So other engineers took the Wright brothers' technology and then improved it?
Or the control system. The Wright brothers' planes were faulty anyway because they had their propellers behind the wings and they had their elevator system in front of the wings. And the French discovered immediately that a better placement for the engine and for the propellers was in front of the wings rather than behind the wings, and that the elevator should go at the tail and not in front. The Wright brothers' planes were completely unstable. And in fact, the Wright brothers built planes for the U.S. Army, and they had to be grounded because the pilots were being killed right
now. This is just you're destroying everything for me. So I'm going to take a break.
No.
If you join us, if you did join us late, this guy who is tearing down the Wright brothers is really their preeminent historian in North Carolina and celebrates him. So we're going to take a break and then we'll come back and get him to tell us why the Wright brothers are important, even if there were some faults in the airplanes along the way. And we're doing that all in the context of Larry Tice's new book called Circa 1903, which is a look at the Outer Banks at the time of the Wright brothers' flight, totally divorced from the Wright brothers' efforts. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm enjoying my conversation with Larry Tice. We're together really to celebrate the publication of his latest book, which is called Circa 1903, and the subtitle is North Carolina's Outer Banks at the Dawn of Flight. And the Dawn of Flight reminds us that the Wright brothers' first flight occurred in North Carolina. And we're talking a little bit about the Wright brothers. And Larry, you, just to remind folks, you were the historian of the centennial of the Wright brothers' flight. You were the Orville and Wilbur Wright Distinguished Professor at East Carolina. So you have good feelings about the Wright brothers.
Absolutely.
But as a historian, you got to be honest about what their their accomplishment was. Yeah. And before the break, you said when the Wright brothers went public in 1908 with their flights that in France, within a month.
6 months.
Within six months.
Well, 6 months to a year. Yeah.
The French airplane builders were building models that were superior to the Wright brothers.
Right.
Well, what happened to the Wright brothers afterwards? Did they come along and build better planes, or were they just historical figures then? Holders of patents and
they held the patent in the United States. Unfortunately, their patents in all of Europe were ended because technically information got out about their designs before they got the patents, and in those other countries, and those other countries did not want to support American flight. Basically, they wanted their own home industries. It's very much like today. Everybody wanted their own technologies. But really and truly, the Wright brothers, their purpose in going to Kitty Hawk, North Carolina in 1900, as they said, was to solve the problem of flight or the question of flight. And they did it. They solved the problem. And the problem was control. I mean, a lot of people could fling a flying machine into the air, one way or another. They could go to the top of a mountain and jump off and try to fly. But the Wright brothers figured out how to take off from level ground, go into the air, and control. When they came back to Kitty Hawk or Kill Devil Hills in 1908, they flew a circle. They took off at one spot, they flew around and landed at the same spot where they took off. That was an unbelievable accomplishment. Nobody had done that. So when they solved the problem of flight, it was control, being able to take off and know where you were going and control the plane and land where you wanted
to. Why was that a problem? I mean, it's not as much a problem as somebody who's trying to pilot a ship. You use the rudder to guide it. I mean, isn't that the same? Aren't those principles applicable to airplanes that you just put something up and like a sail you?
Not exactly, but it's interesting. I mean, we could go on a long time about this, but all the terminology of flying is the terminology of ships. You know, it's the same thing.
Yeah,
they're airships, and they're pilots, and you know, which you have with ships and port and bow, and you know, all of those terms. But the Wright brothers understood that you had to, when you fly, you have to have a center of gravity. If you can't figure out the center of gravity, then you're going to crash. I mean, it's interesting about these Boeing Max planes. You know, they lose altitude and they basically slide backward into the ground, or they try to compensate and then they dive to the ground. All of that has to do with control. But the Wright brothers invented control. They used a system that they called wing warping, in which they would twist the wings to so that they could go right or left, mm-hmm. or and they used their elevator to go up and down. It's remotely like operating a ship, but it's very
more sophisticated. And we want to move along, but nevertheless. So you're both taking away a little bit from the worship of the Wright brothers, and then you're turning around and telling us, well, what they did was really important.
The Wright brothers figured out how to fly, and they taught the world to fly.
And then the way things work is once you teach people these basic things, they start improving on it, working out the weaknesses of that particular system and turn it into something like a jet plane. You know, over a period of 50 or 60 years, there's a remarkable improvement, making minor improvements all along.
Well, you ask about what the Wright brothers did after that. They had the patent, and they tried to collect royalties from everybody else who created flying machines, and they were somewhat successful in the United States. They were also successful in England, and they were actually paid royalties up through the First World War in England and in the United States. Well, in the United States is a different story. So they went into what's called the patent wars of trying to protect their invention, which is very common when people have patents. And they really contributed almost nothing further to the design of airplanes. But they tried to collect, and they became wealthy, you know, from collecting royalties on their patents. They did build some other airplanes, but they never got away from the concept of the pusher of the propellers and the engine behind the wings.
Well, I tell you what, we got together with Larry Tice, who is my guest, to talk about his new book, Circa 1903, and that is a subtitle, North Carolina's Outer Banks at the Dawn of Flight. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk some about that book. Welcome Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Larry Tice. Larry is a prominent North Carolina historian for many years. He was really in charge of history. He was the historian of the Wright brothers' centennial of flight back in 2003. And, but that's not all he's done. And he's got lots of books about North Carolina history. Larry, tell us what this latest book is, circa 1903, and why, after everything you've written about Eastern North Carolina history, you felt like we needed another book.
While I was studying the Wright brothers, I actually spent three summers at NASA Langley Research Center, and I noticed that there were lots of things in the Wright brothers' photographs that didn't have anything to do with airplanes. And in fact, the Wright brothers were really good photographers. They used glass plate negatives, and so they got just really fabulous photographs. Unfortunately, a lot of their glass plate negatives were later damaged in a flood in Dayton in 1913. However, their glass plate negatives can be blown up with digital technology to the point that you can see every detail in those images. And so I was able to blow these up while I was at NASA Langley and produce the first images we have ever seen of the Kill Devil Hills life-saving station complex. Everybody many people know, have seen pictures of the Kill Devil Hills life-saving station.
Because they had a relationship with the Wright brothers.
Right, so. Right. They were located half a mile away from the life-saving station. And whenever the Wright brothers needed somebody to tote things for them, they went and got the lifesavers and said, come on over, you guys. And that became very important once they put an engine on the plane, because the Wright brothers could not handle those by themselves, so they would call the lifesavers over and say, help us tote these around. But the life-saving station was not just a building, it was a complex. And it was a complex of many, many buildings. And during the hurricane season, the families of the lifesavers would go over and live in houses surrounding the life-saving station. So basically from summer months until through December, the lifesavers and their families would live around the life-saving station. So the life-saving station was a complex. It was a community. And in the backgrounds of these pictures of the airplanes, we could see that the extent of the complex. One of the other things that I was able to do with this technology was to look in dark spaces in the Wright brothers. So, for example, if you take a picture of people standing in front of a house and the windows or the doors look like they're black because of the shadows, with this technology, you could actually go into that darkness and see what is in the darkness. But that's only possible because of glass plate negatives and the infinite detail that's recorded in glass plate negative. And so I did a book, Hidden Images in the Wright Brothers Photographs. But then I kept noticing in the environment. And the Wright brothers took pictures of piles of sand. And I couldn't figure out why in the world they took pictures of piles of sand. That just didn't seem germane to their main topic. And then I realized that they were actually recording the geology and the weather or the results of hurricanes on the coast of North Carolina. The other thing that I noticed is that as I was trying to find out the extent of photography relating to the Wright brothers, I went to Wright State University, which has the prints of the Wright brothers
So some of the best thing is when the glass negative is preserved, but
yes.
In some cases the glass negative is gone, but they made a print.
They made prints, yeah. And so the prints are located at Wright State University. The glass plate negatives are at the Library of Congress. And they have some prints at the Library of Congress as well, but the great prints are at Wright State University. But then I started seeing other pictures that were in magazines, you know, of the Wright brothers, and I wondered, well, where did these come from? And so in 1908, there was a photographer. He was a world-famous he was actually the first photojournalist in the United States. His name was James Hare. He had just traveled with the Japanese army when Japan invaded Russia and defeated Russia in 1903. And so he came back, he worked for Collier's Magazine, and he was assigned to go get the first image of a Wright brothers plane in flight. Because the Wright brothers, they were so secretive, they did not allow the pictures of their flying machines to be published. In fact, their most famous photograph was not published for the first time until after James Hare had gotten a picture of the Wright brothers in flight. So I saw these pictures that James Hare did in some magazines, and I thought, well, James Hare, he wouldn't have gone to Kitty Hawk and not taken pictures of other things. And so I went on a search to try to find, well, where are James Hare's photographs located? And lo and behold, I found that they were located in the Harry Ransom Center at the University of Texas, and thousands of pictures that he took. And so I contacted the Harry Ransom Center and I said, do you have any pictures of made by James Hare of the Outer Banks while he was there? I'll just use that term, the Outer Banks.
Talk about that in a minute.
Yeah, they had all of these photographs. They had not processed them. They had not created a finding aid. But I went to the Harry Ransom Center. They allowed me to go through all of his photographs, and I found I think it was 28 images that he made while he was in Mandio and on the Carolina coast, and they are spectacular. So then I started finding other photographs, and I became interested in the world that the Wright brothers—
in the surrounding area when they were there. So yeah. This is theoretically— has nothing to do with the Wright brothers' flight,
right?
But it has something to do because
of what they saw.
What they saw and what they and the Wright brothers as and their family as photographers.
Yes, yes, yes.
As documenters of life in this part of North Carolina, in and around 1903.
Yeah, and in fact, a lot of people don't know that their brother Lauren, who was older, traveled with them, or he actually came while they were in camp. In Kitty Hawk and Kill Devil Hills, and he was an excellent photographer. And a lot of the pictures that we identify as the Wright brothers photographs were taken by Lauren. And in addition to that, most people don't know, the Wright brothers had other aeronauts in their camps when they were in Kitty Hawk and Kill Devil Hills. And these other aeronauts took pictures as well. I mean, if you've got a picture of Wilbur on a flying machine and Orville chasing the flying machine, who's taking the picture? It's got to be somebody else. And so these aeronauts who came to town took a lot of their pictures.
What do you mean, aeronauts?
Well, an aeronaut is somebody who would like to fly, and they are trying to fly. And most of the people who came to the Wright brothers' camps had their own ideas about the design of airplanes, and they saw the Wright brothers fly, and they said that, well, we have better ideas, but they were not successful. It's very hard to do what the Wright brothers did.
Well, if you join us late, we're visiting with Larry Tice. We're talking about his new book, Circa 1903, North Carolina's Outer Banks at the Dawn of Light. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Larry Tice. Larry is, he's not retired, but he was once the Wilburn Orville Wright professor, distinguished professor of history at East Carolina University, and longtime in the center and at the lead of history in North Carolina. The new book is sort of a book of photographs, but there are a lot of writing in there. What do the photographs show about 1903 that we would be interested in today?
The book started out to be a photography book, but it turned into an illustrated history. And so I actually write a history of the Carolina coast at this period of time. And I should say that the title includes the term the North Carolina's Outer Banks at the dawn of flight, but the term Outer Banks does not appear in the rest of the book.
Because why?
The term Outer Banks had not been invented in 1903.
Is that right? The Wright brothers never heard of the Outer Banks.
No.
What did they call it?
The Barrier Islands or the Sand Banks. But no, they didn't. The term Outer Banks was a fiction created by tourist promoters, mainly by David Stick and his father, Frank Stick.
Well, but they were your colleagues.
David Stick was my colleague, and I revere him. He was fabulous, but he inherited thousands of acres of land that he converted into Southern Shores. So he had a lot of buildings he wanted to sell. But he also invented the term Graveyard of the Atlantic, which was not a term known in 1900. So I want people—
– So these are like from the 1950s or—
– 20s.
From
20s and 30s. When the Depression hit in 1929 and people didn't have money anymore, but they had land and they wanted to sell land. And so all of a sudden, on the coast of North Carolina, the Lost Colony and the First Flight and pirates— – became very important in selling the history of the area. Mm-hmm. But in this book, there are 130 images. It's a combination of prints, maps, glass plate negatives, lantern slides, almost every—
Showing what?
Showing people and places. A lot of it has to do with the commercial infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
The Carolina coast had the most sophisticated infrastructure. The Wright brothers could get on a train in Dayton, and the next day they would be in Kitty Hawk. You can't do that today, not by train, and you can't do it by driving, but they could do it. So it's about the infrastructure. And it's also about how people worked and what they did. And one thing that you'll notice is that in almost every picture of people at work, there are blacks and whites working side by side because there was a very large black population.
That surprised me, Larry Tice, because I think of the Outer Banks now as being a white world mostly. But this is there's some beautiful black people who are very much a part of the life as you portray it.
Yeah, well, I love those photographs. I mean, there are pictures of school classes of black or students in black schools. This is right at the time that Plessy versus Ferguson allowed segregated schools, and North Carolina was a leader in segregating schools. North Carolina was a leader in implementing the implications of a white supremacy culture. And that's another thing that I get into because there are probably 8 or 9 pictures of the monument at Fort Raleigh, which is where the Raleigh's colonies were located. And there was a monument erected in 1896, which happened to be the same year as Plessy versus Ferguson, which was reverence to the white English people who brought civilization to North America. It was right at a moment when white people in North Carolina looked to white culture as the civilization, and blacks, and not only blacks, Indians, because North Carolina had a huge Indian population.
But in 1903, was there a huge
No. Indians were everywhere. North Carolina today has 100,000 Indians. It had 100,000 Indians in 1900. But see, what happened in North Carolina is Indians who weren't moved west of the Mississippi, like the Cherokee, became defined as people of color. And so there are Indians everywhere in eastern North Carolina. And in some of these images, you can distinguish that even though they were classified as blacks, at the time, they were actually Indians. And that's one of the vagaries of the white supremacy movement in North Carolina. But the other pictures that I just love in this book is the environment, the trees that are bent from salt shear, the types of boats that were used, the steamships that were used, but the landscape is
who? Excuse me, we just got a minute or two more. Yeah. But I love this description of your book and the love you obviously put into it. Who's buying the book? Who do you think wants this kind of book? Is this the tourist that you've loaded up on so much? Are they they're the ones who are going to buy it? Or do you think historians or just people who love photography, Wright brothers, fanatics? Who in your mind, who is the book aimed at? It's clearly a creation of love for your work in history. Who else is going to buy it?
Well, there are hundreds of thousands of people who come to North Carolina, mainly from Pennsylvania and Michigan and West Virginia. I sign books on the coast, and I ask people where they're from. There are no North Carolinians. They're all from elsewhere. And so I want them to learn that the coast of North Carolina was not about pirates. It was not about lost colony. It was not about first flight. It was a distinctive area of North Carolina, geologically, historically, and culturally. And I want them to go away and say that they learned something about the coast of North Carolina, that it's not just a tourist place. I mean, you go to the Carolina coast today, and it's all hotels and rental buildings. And you know, where's the history? And so those people I want North Carolinians who have gone to what they call the Outer Banks to learn something about what it really was. It was just as important at the turn of the 20th century as it is today, and it was uncluttered in 1900. Today, you can't find the coast because of all of the buildings in the way.
Well, you're laughing or smiling as you say this, and part of you, whenever there's a criticism of commercial development, you have to say, did we want it to stay the same? Did we want it to be? Or people in the Chapel Hill, you know, we talk about these high buildings being built and the traffic clutter and everything. Mm-hmm. And talk about Chapel Hill as it was in the old days, and it was, you know, really a charming place in many respects. But would we really want to go back to the way it was?
Well, let's put it this way. Frank Stick and David Stick, they had a lot of land, and they wanted people to come down and buy land, and they gave the land to create the Cape Hatteras National Seashore. They gave it. And they gave the land where the Wright brothers had their first flight. So they not only were trying to make money, but they were thinking about the environment. I mean, both Frank Stick and David Stick were great environmentalists, and they wanted to protect it as well. I think both of them would turn over in their graves today, to see what had happened. Well, it's not going back. It's understanding what it was.
Well, I think I ask you the question about who would buy the book, and is that the Styx would have loved the book.
Yeah. Because.
And even though all of them, and I have to put you in the category, have built up the history of that region so much that people do come as tourists because of what you all did.
Yes.
Thanks to Larry Tice for taking time on his visit to Chapel Hill to talk about his book, Circa 1903. Larry, welcome back to Chapel Hill.
Well, thank you very much. It's great fun,
and
as always.
Thanks to all of you. Thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, and I'll be back here before you know it.